Welcome to Off Script with Dan Dwyer on Robinhood Radio, featuring in-depth interviews with guests from the world of theater and allied arts. Underwriting support from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. And now, here's the host of Off Script, Dan Dwyer.
Well, thank you, Marshall, and welcome to Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. For those of us who happen to have an Irish background, and for those of us who know that New England history was dominated by old WASP families, there's plenty of interest in a new novel called The Latecomers, a sprawling multi-generational story that really deals with motherhood and a very special mystery behind it. Add to it that the author is a resident of Salisbury, Connecticut, and the house where she actually lives informs her storytelling, too. My guest today is Helen Klein Ross, the author of two previous novels, What Was Mine and Making It, a novel of Madison Avenue. She's here to talk to me about The Latecomers, which is being published this month by Little Brown, and for which Helen will have a reading and a book signing at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury on Tuesday evening, November 6th. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you, Dan. I'm so glad to be here.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. Congratulations on the book. I finished it yesterday, and I shouldn't say – when I say finish, it's not a task to read it because it's a handy 400 pages. It's very well written. It's compelling. It's an easy read. It's fun to read. And also the structure of it, which maybe we can get into, makes it even more easy to read too. But anyway, we've got a lot to talk about. The story itself – how the story came about, and also how you write, which is really kind of beautiful. So first, let's start off. Just tell us what the premise of The Latecomers is.
The premise is really a family, a Connecticut blue blood family, and how they are changed forever by an Irish girl who comes as an immigrant in 1908. And makes her way from Ellis Island to a small town in Connecticut where she works for the Hollingworths until she doesn't anymore. Mm-hmm. And life for the Hollingworths and Bridie changes forever. It encompasses about 118 years of American history. So I'm glad to hear you say that the structure made it easy to follow, because that was my greatest fear as an author of this. How do you tell a story that evolves over the course of more than a century in a way that makes sense to a reader?
Also, most of these historical dramas that you read or historical fiction that you read, it's A to B to C to D with a lot of details in between. And the way you structure it, you've got a series of very, very brief chapters that basically get right to which character you're talking about, when it's happening to them, what's happening to them, and where it's happening to them. So it's perfectly obvious about where your characters are relating to each other and the place, which is very important in your book.
I started to write linearly, just mm-hmm. as you're saying, because it seemed to make sense. Well, I start, if Bridie comes in 1908, that's where I should start. So the first chapter the first chapter that I wrote was based in 1908. But as I went along, it's a multi-generational tale, so that if you do that, you kind of lose interest. By the time the great greats come along and it's 9/11, you sort of lose interest in it, or you lose track of the story. So I began to mix it up, which seemed to be a much better approach. And my editor asked me, or the assistant editor actually, asked me to, instead of just putting the chapter numbers and the person from whose point of view it is, could we also put the location?
Exactly.
And at first I resisted that, and then I thought, okay. And that I'm so glad that Alex made that suggestion, because it really makes the book hang together, I think.
You mentioned you opened up the book with a scene involving some of the characters of this family who are tragically involved in 9/11, which was shocking to me, because that's not how the book presents itself by way of its cover design, which is wonderful, incidentally, and also the little bit that I did know about it. But you cut from that going way back to when Bridie is leaving Ireland. Could you read that portion from
the book? Oh, sure, yeah.
Where that's happening, and set it up for us a little bit.
So I'm going to read a little bit from page, it's, I think, 23. And this was the first thing that I wrote. So I thought this would be the first chapter, but as you point out, actually it's not. So this is Bridie and her intended, Tom, mm-hmm. are 16 years old, leaving Ireland in 1908 in secret. So their families don't know, and Tom's idea was that they would stop by the rectory and get married before they get on a ship. His brother has sent them tickets from Poughkeepsie to get on a ship, which is the way it was done. A lot of Irish came over, worked, and sent tickets home. So Tom has a ticket. They stop to the rectory to get married, but alas, the priest isn't there. He's been called away in the night by a midwife.
Okay, so
and now I'm going to begin to read.
Helen Klein Ross reading from The Latecomers.
Bridie dreaded going home, which she assumed they would do. How could they travel together unwed? But Tom put a hand on her back and said, "We've got to go, Bridie. The tickets will expire if we don't use them." His brother had sent tickets from a place called Poughkeepsie. Pink slips of paper so valuable they seemed to glow in his pocket. They cost 2 months of what Tom earned working as an apprentice to Mr. Dollard, the carpenter. But in 24 hours, if they turned back, the tickets would turn into worthless pieces of paper.
That's Helen Klein Ross. She's just read to us from her new novel called The Latecomers. It's being published this month by Little Brown. And Helen will be at the White Hart Inn in Salisbury, Connecticut on Tuesday evening, November 6th, for a reading and a book signing. Now, what figures largely into the book, and I know this from personal experience because in all transparency, I should probably tell our listeners we're friends, and I, like a lot of people in Salisbury, have been to your house. But where you live in Salisbury really informs so much of the story. Tell us how that all figured
this,
in.
Yeah, this story would not exist if we hadn't bought a falling down governor's house built in 1853.
Which, incidentally, I knew of and had been in many times before you bought it. So when you go through the book and you describe its kind of agedness and the nature of the radiators and how the wiring was put in kind of over time, and I remember that.
And the old lamps. Yeah. I mean, that's what fascinated me. You know, I'd be sitting in the living room, and one of the things that made me just fall in love with the house was an old floor-to-ceiling bookcase, carved fruit wood and 1860 engraved in the pane, in the glass panes. And I would wonder what conversations took place by the doors of this bookcase during the Civil War. You know, imagine how that must have been for the people living there, worried about the country literally being torn apart. And so I really crafted a book of conversations that happened in the walls, as I imagine them. The book is not about real people, but it's what could have happened in the house. I'm very interested in places that stay, that remain, and people in them change. So the house is a perfect example to me. Mm-hmm. The book starts on 9/11 when someone is going back to the house that their great-great-grandfather built. And then we also have a chapter with the great-grandfather who is – so to me it's really interesting to think about the stories, all the stories that happen in the place that you live.
Without giving too much away, I was listening to what you were saying, and what's really remarkable, and this is, I think, remarkable about how you weave the tale, is that both literally and metaphorically, the walls give up the truth.
and we'll
leave it at that. That's part of the mystery. Let's get to the Irish aspect of it. Dan Dwyer. Irish American name. I think you too share Irish American background. Growing up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and you grew up in?
I grew up outside Philadelphia. I grew up in a few places, mostly outside Philadelphia.
You know, I remember my father. There's a thing about being Irish American in the 20th century and growing up in a society, in a town where the WASPs and the Blue Bloods predominated. I remember growing up in New Bedford, Massachusetts, and my father came from an ordinary Irish American family, and he worked for the old Blue Bloods in town when he was in high school when they lost their money during the Depression. So as Irish Americans, you know, old enough to remember how the ascendancy really happened with the Kennedy presidency and all that, there's not a chip on the shoulder, but there is a tension between those who think they're really American And Waspy and all those that came later.
Well, I think,
do you tap into that at all a little bit, or am I putting too much of what I
no,
my experience
Dan,
into the book?
You totally got the heart of the impetus behind this book. I began to write this book on November 9th, 2016. I'd actually received a book contract, a very good book contract that summer. But you know what? I was too happy to work because I got a great book contract and we were going to have the first woman president.
Right.
And an immigrant story, I don't know, was it that urgent? I don't know. But on November 9th, 2016, it felt like an immigrant story was urgent. So that day, I began writing just fueled by all this energy and passion I had and wanting to talk about an immigrant, using the Irish-American immigrants, which because of my family background, I knew something about. But I don't think I think the immigrant experience, whether you experience it in 1908 or 2018, there's some similarities, and that's what I was interested in.
Let's dig down a little deeper. Okay, you've got a house that's an old house that you're fascinated with, and I should add that in your house where I've been to, you actually have a part of it, a room in it, that's dedicated to all the artifacts that you found
in
the house.
A little history room.
Okay. So then you've got the impetus of being personally moved by what didn't happen on November 6th and the whole notion of the outsider, the immigrant, the other. Okay? Let's talk about motherhood now.
Mm.
Because you've written two books. The last one was...
What Was Mine,
which is a story about a mother who isn't a mother but who kidnaps a child to become a mother, leaving a real mother motherless. Okay? So that's a kind of a peculiar take. And this story, without getting into the details, talks about motherhood in, let's say, a set of unusual occurrences.
That's very well said.
Okay.
Very well said.
Without giving the mystery behind.
Yeah.
Your mother got two daughters. So why have you taken motherhood but written two stories that really make us think of motherhood in ways that aren't typical?
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for asking that. Motherhood to me is another huge impetus for writing. And I believe we're given the themes. I didn't actually pick motherhood, but when I write, I find myself writing about motherhood in all its various forms. I think I'm very interested in borders and who is what and who isn't what. And motherhood is such a powerful force. What makes a mother? Who isn't a mother? Who is a mother? I find myself just really interested in exploring those questions. And I don't know why. You know, I think as a writer, you take the subjects that move you, the subjects that you're given, and you don't really have a say in it when you do fiction. I think writing nonfiction is maybe different. You're interested in exposing something. But for fiction, you sit down at a blank page and you just tell a story. And the stories come from somewhere deep inside you. You're subconscious or unconscious, and I think the more they come from that place or you let them come from that place, the better they are.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that place, motherhood apparently is a big theme of mine.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
Let's drill down even deeper and go from motherhood to sex, okay? Because your book is beautifully written in a style of prose that's at one time incredibly precise, but at the same time just pregnant and full of possibilities.
I love the opportunity to describe first sex in 1910 and 1993 and somewhere in between. I was really interested in that. Like, what is it like for a girl in, you know, a new bride in 1910? What is it like for a boarding school girl in the 1990s? What is it like for people in between? I really had fun.
Yeah, the contrast was really remarkable because it's not just what it was like for those women at those different times, because it's really not pleasurable to the women in the first cases, is it? Was it?
Well, the wedding night often was not, yes.
Right. But it is sort of pleasurable and a moment of celebrated discovery in the today case with a younger woman. But besides that, you describe them in ways that are perfectly accurate to the style of writing at the period. through the eyes of the characters.
Good. I'm glad you
found
that.
Yeah, so that came
glad.
Through too.
Thank
yeah.
You.
Yeah. So that's all you want to say about sex.
Well, no, okay. I think I don't know. Is there any more specific questions? I'm interested in what unites different people. Mm-hmm. So girls, virgins who are separated by 100 years, when they have sex for the first time, yes, there's differences, but there's also similarities. And how does that impact you? How does that affect you? How does that and what is it like for guys? You know, I'm very interested in men as well, not just women. And men in the days of 1910 seemed to me encouraged not to express their feelings and to have a certain very male viewpoint on life. And that also impacted the sexual experience for women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Getting down to the factual research for the book, what was distinctive about your book, I know I've seen it before, but we don't see it very often. In the back of the book, you list all the research that you did for this work of fiction, yeah. including not just where you went to do your research, like the Morgan Library and the Salisbury Association here in town, but also all of – it's a really good bibliography on late 19th century, early 20th century American society and American culture. And from a local point of view, a lot of people will recognize, even though it's in – what town have you called it? Wellington?
It's Wellington.
Wellington, Connecticut. Well, many people will recognize some aspects of it as Lakeville or Salisbury. And it's remarkably detailed. I mean, you get into detail about – the structural skeleton of Grand Central when it was going up, to how rice isn't available in Ireland in the 1920s, to even a visit of President Taft to Connecticut. Mm. How long did it take you to do all this research, and how do you, as a writer who's trying to tell the story from an emotional point of view, don't get bogged down in a lot of esoterica that colors the story, but that doesn't really shape it?
That's a great question. And that it would have been so easy for me to still be in those rabbit holes
exactly.
of what people wore in 1910 to the wedding. I come from advertising, and so you were trained to do a pitch for a product category that you've never heard of, say, you know, a new invention, a new drug. So you have only a limited time to research that. So I use the skills that I learn in advertising to make myself stop researching. And I got lots of great research. Catherine Chilcott, who was the town historian when we took the house, was very helpful early on in the, 2012, 2013, sharing details. I also had a stint at the New York Public Library in the Allen Room, where if you're a writer with a contract, you are afforded a research place on the second floor. I also went to the Salisbury Association. I went to the Connecticut Historical Library in Hartford. There was lots of really interesting places of research that was available to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I really had to use discipline, though, not to spend forever
right.
researching. That would be really fun to write a nonfiction book based on research, but...
There are so many characters in the book, but there are a couple of major ones. Is there any one character that you found the easiest to write, or was there any character that you found, because of the role they had to take in the story, difficult to write because maybe you didn't like all the aspects of his or her character?
Bridie was the easiest.
Sure.
Bridie was the first character out of the box for me.
Can we say it's her story, right?
It's her. Yes, yeah. It's the story of Bridie. Yeah.
Yeah.
Her son was also easy for me because my great uncle wrote letters to my mother at her request, describing what it was like to be a kid in 1910 in Chicago. So some of his descriptions of urban life for boys in that year informed Vincent's character. In fact, I gave Vincent his birthday.
Ah.
This is Edward Callahan.
Uh-huh.
Sarah was
so now we get the Irish background here.
Yes,
it's a Callahan you're talking about.
Whalen Callahan.
All right, Whalen and Callahan, sure. All right.
Yeah, my mom was raised Irish Catholic
sure.
in Chicago, and I would go every summer, and we'd hang out with all the relatives. My grandmother would have big dinners, and the stories were
That'll
just amazing.
That'll do it to you.
Yeah, right. I would say Sarah was a little difficult for me because Sarah was a prod, as they're called in Irish Catholic America, the prods.
Yeah.
And not having been raised blue blood or a prod, it was a little – but, you know, talking to people was really helpful. You know, I spoke with many people in town, John Hoffman, many, you know, people who had a different kind of background than my own. And researching and reading Edith Wharton and reading F. Scott Fitzgerald, reading fiction that took place in that time where the characters were not Irish Catholic.
Right.
That was helpful.
Yeah.
And also your imagination kicks in.
There's a little hint of some benign mental illness in Sarah, isn't there? Maybe a little bit?
Well,
personality defect a little bit?
Really?
No?
Do you think? I didn't mean her to have that, perhaps.
No. I mean, she's moody.
She's – well, look at her. You know, she doesn't have it so easy.
Uh-huh.
I think women didn't have it so easy in those days. I mean, she finds herself
– We don't have
doing,
to too much
yeah,
of a plot.
Doing
yeah,
what she hadn't planned on doing.
Right.
And needing other things.
Right.
And also, there wasn't suffrage yet. There was a lot of – it was kind of interesting to research blue blood New England women. Clubs were a huge thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you had your nanny, you had your domestic help, you know, and your husband was out all day working, and so you needed to occupy yourself. So there was all these clubs with these crazy names,
right.
Like, you know, clubs to make America great again.
Yeah. Let's give it a shot.
Yeah, right.
The other thing that's distinctive about the book, because it's beautifully and economically written, even though it covers, what, four generations, five generations?
Five generations,
Five generations
yeah.
and over 100 years. It never bogs down. It's not wordy. It's just so precise and economically written. But it does depend, as all good pieces of fiction do, going back to Dickens and probably before, on a lot of coincidence. Okay?
Mm.
And I'm kind of cynical, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I'm reading the book and, you know – But this, and I'm saying, and but I never went, oh, come on, Helen. I mean, I know I'm reading coincidence, but at every turn, you're making it like really believable. I didn't stop for a minute and say, oh, come on, Helen. How do you do that?
The thing about writing fiction, so here's what I think. Life is full of coincidence. And often when something happens, I think, oh, but I could never put that in the book because it would be unbelievable. But the thing is, life is full of coincidences that happen. And so I gave myself permission to make it more like life and less like fiction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's – yeah.
There's one scene in the book. I don't want to give too much away. When you wrote this book – and I'll leave it – maybe this is a crazy question. Did Citizen Kane ever come to mind, the Rosebud?
Oh,
The opening scene of Rosebud where he's – dying on the bed and he drops the snowflake scene. Do you know what I'm talking about
now? I
didn't
consciously think of that.
But you know what I'm talking about
now. I
do
know what you're talking about.
And we should leave it at that, shouldn't we?
That's a great yes.
We should leave it at that. The other thing I want to say is that chapter, and I'm going to call it the Rosebud chapter now, okay, is the most remarkable death scene I think I've ever read in a book because – you've got two characters who know the inevitability of this particular character, and you describe an event to the character that's not in the place, but it's so richly detailed, and they're not even observing that, but something's happening at the same time where it all comes together. Mm. It's a pretty remarkable chap, that little two pages. And particularly when in less than 50 pages later or 40 pages later, you put it all together. In a really, really surprising way. What was the most difficult part of pulling this together?
I think the structure was the hardest part because I had just piles of pages everywhere and how am I going to do this? And once I figured out that, yes, you can give yourself permission not to do it in a linear fashion, the reader will come along with you because readers are pretty sophisticated now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you read novels written in the 18th – not I'm not talking Proust, but readers were not as knowledgeable about how to read a story, how to come through a novel. Now readers are pretty smart. So I think you can give them credit for being able to follow you as long as you give them certain signs, map signs, But the structure was definitely the hardest part for me.
Yeah.
The research was hard, but it was really fun. Right. So I didn't really consider that work.
Right.
Okay. And then at the end, you know, you're sort of filling in because I didn't do it linearly. I ended up back writing chapters like Sarah in her 80s. I wrote later. A few chapters I dropped in later because they were like in my heart, but they weren't on the page yet. Mm-hmm. And so I knew that once I got finished the first or second manuscript, mm-hmm. then I realized, oh, wait, we need to see Sarah later.
Right.
It was a notion of bringing the characters all as far as you could over those 100 years
right.
to keep the reader interested in these people.
And you've done it really successfully. Congratulations again.
Thank you so
much, Dan. And thanks for being on Off Script.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
The book, The Latecomers, published this month by Little Brown, the author, Helen Klein Ross, a resident of Salisbury, and she will be at the White Hart Inn on Tuesday evening, November 6th at 6 o'clock, 6:30, 6 o'clock?
6 o'clock, 6 o'clock.
6 o'clock Tuesday
Come
evening,
after you
November
vote.
6th. Yes, indeed. Or vote twice or three, vote often. Tuesday evening, November 6th at the White Hart, Helen Klein Ross for the Latecomer book signing. This has been Off Script. I'm your host, Dan Dwyer. Thanks for joining us, and until the next time you do, be well.
Underwriting support for Off Script with Dan Dwyer from Johnny Cake Books in Salisbury, Connecticut, whose collection of rare, collectible, and out-of-print books is housed in a 19th-century cottage in one of the most old-fashioned small towns in New England. Off Script with Dan Dwyer is also available via podcast on our on-demand page, robinhoodradio.com. Click on On Demand, and then click on Off Script with Dan Dwyer.